just some shit with this girl,
Luke said.
Who? Shorty with the books?
Luke hesitated, then needing to tell someone, said,
She told me she was pregnant.
CJ laughed, a strange, wheezing laugh.
Oh, that's easy, he said. Real simple. Don't give her shit until you know it's yours. I don't care how fucking cute that kid looks. Don't even buy his ass some diapers before you swab him.
She ain't been with no one but me, Luke said. He didn't know that, of course, but he knew he'd been her first. She hadn't admitted that she was a virgin, but he'd felt it from her tightness, from the little gasp she'd made once he'd entered her, from the way she clenched her eyes when he'd barely moved. 3 times he asked if she wanted him to stop. 3 times she shook her head. She was the type of girl who never wanted to admit that she was in pain, as if not confessing it made her stronger. Her mother had died 2 months ago, and he knew that was the reason she was fucking him. Why she hadn't mentioned his limp, why she'd pulled his fat Charlie's shirt over his head, even though it smelled like sweat and grease. She was a 17-year-old with a dead mother, and she wanted him to fuck the sadness out of her. Every time he felt guilty for hurting her, she wrapped her arms tighter around his back so he sank deeper, moving as slowly as he could until he finished with a tiny shudder. Later, he pretended not to notice the blood on her sheets. He rolled closer to her and slept on top of the uneven spots. CJ blew a puff of smoke toward the crumbling tile roof and tossed what was left of the joint in a puddle.
Still, he said, you better get that kid tested. If you even act like he's yours, the state's taking all your money. Happened to a dude I know. The laws are all fucked up.
She didn't keep it, Luke said.
Well, shit,
CJ clapped him on the back.
That's even easier. You got lucky, homie.
Luke didn't feel lucky. When Nadia had first told him, he'd felt wired, the way he used to feel right after he'd finished lifting, like little sparks were running under his skin. Just to think, that morning his biggest worry had been getting to work on time so he wouldn't get fired from his shitty job. And now a baby. A whole fucking baby. He felt terrible. She looked miserable, barely eating anything. But a small part of him had felt amazed by what they'd done. He'd helped create a whole new person, a person who'd never existed before in the entire world. Most days, the biggest thing he managed to accomplish was to recite the lunch specials from memory. He imagined rushing to the break room once she left, to log on to the work computer and Google, when pregnancy shows, how to stop pregnancy sickness, how much it costs to raise a child. Then Nadia told him she wanted an abortion. He'd promised he'd get her the money, even though he'd only saved $200 for his apartment. Wads of cash tucked in an orange Nike box under his bed. It had been all too easy to blow his paychecks on beer and sneakers, and he'd felt stupid, pulling his life's savings out of a shoebox. How had he ever thought he could find a way to raise a kid? He hadn't planned to leave her at the clinic. But the day of the appointment, when he slid his cell phone into his work locker like he did every day, it dawned on him how easy it was to walk away. He had done his part, and she had done hers, and he would never have to see her again. He wouldn't have to imagine what she might look like after the surgery, grief-stricken, in pain, or find the right words to comfort her. He wouldn't have to tell her that she had made the right decision, or that he felt like he had barely made a decision at all. He could just lock the phone up and walk away, This was his gift, a body tied to no one. But then he'd seen her at Cody Richardson's party, and she hadn't looked unpregnant. He'd only seen the word once before, years ago, when his father's congregation had joined a protest out in front of the abortion clinic. He was just a boy then, clinging to his mother's side because the other marchers made him nervous. A red-faced man in a camouflage puffy vest stomped around chanting, "It's a war out here, man, and we're the front line." An old black man held a sign that said, "Abortion is black genocide." A nun carried a photo of a bloody baby's head squeezed by forceps. "There's no such thing as an unpregnant woman," the sign read, "just a mother of a dead baby." Years later, Luke hadn't forgotten that sign. The word unpregnant had stuck with him even more than the graphic photograph. Its finality, its sheer strangeness, not pregnant, but a different category of woman altogether. An unpregnant woman, he'd always thought, would somehow wear her unpregnancy as openly as pregnant women did. But when Nadia Turner had pushed inside the party, she looked no different than when he'd last seen her. Leggy in her high heels, a red blouse hugging her breasts, paining him with her prettiness. She wasn't even crying. He was the weak one who couldn't bring himself to face her. Now he couldn't stop breaking things. If you dropped one dish during your shift, Charlie just humiliated you at the next staff meeting. Two, and he took you off tables for the rest of the night. Luke counted the tip money in his pockets. $15 in crumpled ones and a few nickels. Not even gas money. He glanced at CJ, who was still grinning at him, in awe of his good fortune. "Guess I am lucky," Luke said, blowing smoke into the sour air. That summer, Nadia spent more nights in Aubrey Evans' bed than in her own. She slept on the right side, farthest from the bathroom, because Aubrey got up more in the middle of the night. In the morning, she brushed her teeth and left her toothbrush in the holder by the sink. She ate breakfast in the chair nearest the window, her feet bunched up on the edge of her seat. She drank her juice out of Casey's bright orange Vols cup. She left clothes in Aubrey's room, accidentally at first, a sweatshirt forgotten on the back of a chair, a swimsuit left in the dryer. Then she forgot things on purpose. Soon, when Monique dumped a laundry basket on the bed, the girl's clothes tangled into an indistinguishable knot. It wasn't hard to move into someone else's life if you did it a little at a time. Aubrey no longer asked if she wanted to spend the night. After work, when they walked out to the parking lot, Aubrey unlocked the passenger side and waited for Nadia to climb inside. Aubrey was lonely, too. She hadn't made many friends at school. She'd spent more time volunteering at church than going to football games or dances. It was strange, learning the contours of another's loneliness. You can never know it all at once, like stepping inside a dark cave you felt along the walls, bumped into jagged edges.
"You sure you're not wearing out your welcome over there?"
her father asked one night. "No," she said. "Aubrey invited me."
"But you're over there all the time now."
"So now you care where I go?" she said. He paused in her doorway.
"Don't get smart with me," he said.
She went anyway, even though on most nights, she and Aubrey did nothing at all, lounging on the couch, watching bad reality TV, and painting each other's nails. They drove downtown and ducked inside little shops at the harbor. Last summer, Nadia had worked there at JoJo's Juicery, smiling plaintively while people squinted at the rainbow-colored menu above her head. She had daydreamed while following smoothie recipes on laminated index cards taped to the counter. She served rich white people, mostly, who strolled with pastel sweaters tied around their shoulders, as if carrying them was too much work. She had never been inside any of the harbor restaurants like Dominic's Italian or Lighthouse Oysters, fancy places she could never afford. But she joked with the waiters sometimes when they came inside JoJo's. A waitress at Divino's told her how a Hollywood producer had yelled, "Al dente, al dente, that means to the tooth," at her, and sent his linguine back three times until it was firm enough. He was trying to impress his date, a weathered blonde woman who barely reacted, which just seemed sad. What was the point of being a Hollywood producer if you had to yell at waitresses to impress women? At least no one would try to impress a date at JoJo's. During work, she liked to stare out the glass at the boats docked along the harbor, their colorful sails furled, but sometimes it made her sad. She'd never been inside a boat, and they were docked 20 feet away. She'd never been anywhere. Some evenings, she stayed after work to help Aubrey volunteer. They packed food baskets for the homeless and cleaned Sister Willis's classroom, scrubbing the chalkboards and scraping Play-Doh off the tables. On Friday nights, they hosted senior bingo, dragging in stacks of metal chairs, setting up snacks, and calling out numbers the seniors asked them to repeat at least three times. Other nights, the girls sipped smoothies along the harbor and peered into shop windows at trinkets. In the coming darkness, the boats bobbed and swayed, and later, when she crawled into Aubrey's bed, Nadia felt like one of those boats bobbing in place. She was leaving for college in 2 weeks. She was drifting between two lives, and as excited as she felt, she wasn't quite ready to lose the life she'd found this summer. Sometimes Casey grilled and they all ate dinner in the backyard, then walked down the street for Hawaiian shaved ice. Monique told them stories about work, about a hallucinating man who'd gouged his own eye out, a woman who'd fallen asleep at the wheel and crashed into a fence, nearly impaling herself on the post. One evening, she told them about a girl who had taken illegal abortion pills from Mexico and couldn't bring herself to admit it until she almost bled out on the ER floor. "What happened to that girl?" Nadia asked later while they all washed the dishes. "What girl?" Monique handed her a wet plate. "That girl, the one who took those pills from Mexico." She still couldn't bring herself to say the word abortion. Maybe it would sound different falling out of her mouth. Horrible infection, but she pulled through. These girls are so afraid to tell someone they're pregnant. They get these pills cheap online, and no one knows what's in them. She would have died if she hadn't had enough sense to get help. Monique handed Aubrey a plate. "Don't you girls ever do something like that. You call me, okay? Or Casey. We'll take you to a doctor. Don't ever try to do something like that on your own." Nadia had read online about abortion pills. $40 and delivered to your door in a plain brown box. She would have ordered them herself if Luke hadn't found her the money for the surgery. You didn't know how desperate you could be until you were. "Do you think it's bad?" she asked Aubrey later. "What that girl did?" "Of course. Mo said she almost died." "No, not like that. I mean, do you think it's wrong?" "Oh." Aubrey flipped off the lights, and the other half of the bed lowered beneath her weight. "Why?" "I don't know. Just asking." In the darkness of the room, she could barely make out Aubrey's outline, let alone her face. In the darkness, talking felt safe. She lay on her back, staring up at the ceiling. "Sometimes I wonder," she paused, "if my mom had gotten rid of me, would she still be alive? Maybe she would have been happier. She could have had a life." Any of her other friends would have gasped, turning to her with wide eyes. "Why would you even think that?" they would say, chiding her for entertaining such darkness. But Aubrey just squeezed her hand because she too understood loss, how it drove you to imagine every possible scenario that might have prevented it. Nadia had invented versions of her mother's life that did not end with a bullet shattering her brain. Her mother, no longer cradling a tiny, wrinkled body in a hospital bed, an exhausted smile on her face, but 17 and scared, sitting inside an abortion clinic, waiting for her name to be called. Her mother, no longer her mother, graduating from high school, from college, from graduate school even. Her mother listening to lectures or delivering her own, stationed behind a podium, running a toe up the back of her calf. Her mother traveling the world, posing on the cliffs of Santorini, her arms bent toward the blue sky. Always her mother, although in this version of reality, Nadia did not exist. Where her life ended, her mother's life began. That summer, the girls drove to Los Angeles to explore different beaches. Somehow, sun and sand and salt water seemed better, more glamorous even, in the shadows of Hollywood. They wandered down Venice Beach, past weightlifting jocks and weed dispensaries, t-shirt shops and churro stands and bucket drummers. They swam at Santa Monica Beach and drove through the winding cliffs to Malibu. Other places they went, downtown San Diego, where they rode trolleys across the city, window shopping at Horton Plaza and walking around Seaport Village and sneaking into nightclubs in the Gaslamp District. Nadia sweet-talked a bouncer who let them into an underground club where shot glasses glowed red over the bar, industrial fans spun lazily overhead, and she had to scream into Aubrey's ear to talk. They met boys. Boys tossing footballs on the beach, boys hanging out of car windows, boys smoking cigarettes in front of water fountains, boys, barely still boys, offering to buy them drinks in clubs. Boys bunched around them at the bar, and while Nadia flirted, Aubrey seemed to shrink within herself, her arms folded tightly across her chest. She'd never had a boyfriend before, but how did she expect to ever find one if she never loosened up? So on one of her last nights in Oceanside, Nadia knew exactly where she wanted to take Aubrey: Cody Richardson's house. Aubrey had never been, and in her waning days at home, Nadia felt nostalgic enough to return. Besides, if she was honest with herself, she also hoped she might see Luke. She'd imagined their goodbye. Not dramatic. They weren't dramatic people. But some final conversation where she would see in his eyes the realization that he'd hurt her. She wanted to feel his regret for leaving her, for not loving her like he was supposed to. For once in her life, she wanted an ended thing to end cleanly. The night of the party, she sat on the edge of Aubrey's bed, helping her friend with her makeup. She tilted Aubrey's face toward her, gently sweeping gold eyeshadow across her lids. "You have to wear the dress," she said.
"I told you, it's too short."
"Trust me," she said. "Every guy's gonna want to hook up with you tonight." Aubrey scoffed.
"So? That doesn't mean I want to hook up with them."
Don't you at least want to know what it's like?
What?
Sex, she giggled. Just don't expect it to be all beautiful and romantic. It's gonna be awkward as hell.
Why does it have to be awkward?
Because, look, has any guy ever seen you naked? Now Aubrey opened her eyes.
What?
She said. I mean, what's the furthest you've ever gone?
I don't know. Kissing, I guess.
Jesus Christ, you've never even let a guy fill you up? Aubrey shut her eyes again.
Please,
she said. Can we talk about something else?
Nadia laughed. You're so cute, she said. I was never like you. I lost my virginity and...
She shrugged. I don't even talk to him anymore. She'd never told Aubrey about Luke. She didn't know how to explain their time together, and she'd feel embarrassed trying to, because everything that had happened between them could be traced back to one of her own stupid choices. She was the one who'd gone to Fat Charlie's day after day to see Luke. She had fallen in love with a boy who didn't want anyone to know he was dating her. She'd started sleeping with him months before she was leaving for college, and she hadn't even insisted he wear a condom every time. She had been the type of foolish woman her mother had cautioned her never to be, and she hated the idea of Aubrey knowing this about her. Aubrey opened her eyes again. They were watering, and Nadia dabbed a tissue, careful not to smear her eyeliner.
I wish I could be more like you, Aubrey said.
Trust me, Nadia said. You don't want to be like me. That night, the beach was empty aside from the flicker of a bonfire past the lifeguard tower, almost deserted, like their own private island. She reached for Aubrey's hand, Aubrey lagging behind her, tugging at the black mini dress.
Don't let me drink too much, she said.
That's the point. We're gonna loosen you up.
Nadia, seriously, I'm such a lightweight.
Oh, you can't be that bad. That's what you think.
Cody Richardson's kitchen was more crowded than usual. Tall skaters in ripped skinny jeans howled over beer pong, while beside them, three fat blondes counted out loud before downing tequila shots. On the floor, a pale, freckled girl passed a joint to two skinny boys who were too busy making out to notice. Nadia mixed Aubrey a drink, but she shook her head.
That's too much, she said, pushing the cup back.
It's only two shots.
You didn't even measure it.
I poured for 2 seconds. Same thing.
After her first cup, Aubrey started to relax. After her second, she was smiling, no longer caring that her dress almost showed her ass. After her third, she was dancing with a boy who certainly cared that her dress almost showed her ass, so Nadia pulled her away before he got too handsy. Aubrey was an adorable drunk. She clung to Nadia, throwing her arms around her, toying with her hair. She plopped into her lap, an arm around her shoulder. She told Nadia she loved her twice. Both times, Nadia laughed it off.
No, Aubrey said. I really do love you.
When was the last time anyone had told her that? She felt embarrassed that she couldn't remember, so she pretended not to hear. She twisted open a bottle of water and handed it to Aubrey. Have some, she said, before you puke. Partying at Kobe's sober was a strange experience. She felt like she was in a museum, sneaking under the guardrails for a closer look at the exhibits. She noticed the details, the sadness behind smiles, the tired faces, strained with pretend happiness.
She was comforted, in a way, to know that she wasn't the only one who sometimes faked it. She finished her beer, barely buzzed, while Aubrey tried to goad her into drinking more.
"I can't," Nadia said. "I'm driving."
"But you're not even having fun."
"I am," Aubrey pouted.
"No, you're not."
"Yes, I am, and you're having fun. That's the point."
"But you're just sitting there."
"I'm having fun through you," she said. And she was, oddly enough, even though she was sober, even though she was disappointed that she hadn't seen Luke. She felt grateful, almost, watching Aubrey party with the giddiness of someone who had just wrenched herself free of her body.
"Jesus, Aubrey!"
Nadia hooked an arm around her waist as she helped her up Monique and Casey's driveway.
"You are a lightweight. I'm not that drunk."
"Oh, yes, you are."
"No,
yes, you fucking are."
She fumbled through Aubrey's purse for the gold house key.
"Now shut up, okay? Everyone's probably sleeping."
She clamped a hand over Aubrey's mouth as she shuttled her inside the dark house. Floorboards creaked underneath them, and she stepped lightly, ushering Aubrey down the hall, her hand moist from her breathing. Inside her bedroom, Aubrey flopped onto the bed, stretching out like a starfish. Nadia wiggled out of her dress. She glanced into the mirror. Behind her, Aubrey propped herself up on her elbows, watching her undress.
"You're so pretty," she said.
Nadia laughed, rummaging through the drawer for a t-shirt to sleep in. She felt uncomfortable knowing that Aubrey was looking. She'd never liked anyone watching her undress, not even Luke. She pulled on a faded Chargers t-shirt, piling her hair into a sloppy bun.
"You are," Aubrey said. "You are so pretty, it's not even fair. Come on, let's go to bed." "But I'm not tired."
"Want to change into shorts? You're not sleeping in that, are you?"
"We'll talk, right?" Aubrey said. "When you're in college."
Nadia's throat tightened, but she didn't say anything, shielded by the dark and the quiet.
"Of course," she finally said, unsure if she was trying to comfort Aubrey or herself.
Down the hall, the air conditioner hummed loudly, but her mind refused to settle, not even after Aubrey grew quiet and still beside her. She slept on her stomach like a baby, and in the darkness, Nadia rested a hand on her back, feeling it rise and fall.
"Remember the trampoline," Aubrey said, "that I told you about? The one in my neighbor's yard?"
"What about it?"
Aubrey clenched her eyes shut, her voice dropping to a whisper.
"That was the first secret I ever kept."
In the morning, Luke's bum leg burned, an unusual type of pain. He knew other types well, a side effect from a reckless youth, a broken arm after accepting a dare to swing across the monkey bars blindfolded, sprained ankles and jammed fingers from pickup basketball games taken too seriously, cracked ribs from drunk fights with friends. In college, he learned pain intimately, the tautness of sore muscles, the feverish push beyond all points of reason, the weight of 100 pounds on your back digging into your shoulders, cutting off your breath. The pain of too tired, can't get up, no thinking, just surviving. After football, he didn't think he could ever unlearn pain. He felt violence still in his body, echoing against his bones. The leg hurt differently. Not the sting or swell he knew, just a dull, seasoned pain that felt hot when he stepped, especially in the morning after hours of not moving it. So when his mother banged on his door early one Sunday morning, he took a minute to untangle himself from his covers and shuffle barefoot across the room. Golden shards of light slanted through the slats of the blinds and across his carpet. He eased toward the door, gingerly opening it and poking his head out. In the hallway, his mother stood in a peach skirt suit, her purse clutched under her arm. He squinted into the sunlight, clearing his throat.
"What you need, Mama?"
he said.
"Hi, Mama," she said. "Good morning, Mama. It's so good to see you, Mama." "Sorry, I just woke up." "Let me give you a hug since I don't do nothing but work and hole up in my room all day."
He stepped forward lightly, putting an arm briefly around her shoulders.
"What did I tell you about going to see that doctor?"
she said.
"It don't hurt that bad. Can't hardly walk and still won't listen to nobody."
She shook her head.
"Why are you standing like that in front of the door?"
"You don't want to go in. It's messy."
"You think I don't know that already?" "Come on, Mama, what you need?"
"I don't need anything. I just want to see my son."
"I've been busy," he said.
She scoffed.
"Busy? I know you're still thinking about that Turner girl. You just like your daddy. Can't let the past be the past."
She touched his cheek.
"Look, what's done is done. You got yourself in this mess, and you should be on your knees thanking God for getting you out of it. Don't everybody get another chance, you know that?"
"Yes," he said.
"What you need to do is come to church," she said. "If you'd listened to the word a little more, maybe none of this would have happened."
Luke leaned against the doorframe. He hadn't meant to get his parents involved, but he needed the money quickly, and part of him had hoped that they would scold him for even considering aborting the baby and refuse to give him a dollar. Then he would have returned to Nadia, hangdog, his hands thrown up, and told her that he'd tried his best but couldn't find the money, and maybe they should take a moment and think this over. But his parents, who didn't drink or swear or even watch rated R movies, had helped Nadia kill his baby. He had asked them to.
"Okay," he said. "I'll try to make it."
In Oceanside, seasons blended together into year-round sunshine, but fall came regardless. Cheerful welcome messages now flashed on Oceanside High's electronic marquee, and backpacks and binders had been pushed to the front of Walmart. Nadia had received emails from the University of Michigan informing her of orientation. She tried to swallow her nervousness each time she passed those generic back-to-school images framed in red and orange leaves. In Oceanside, leaves didn't burst into red and orange. They withered and faded into a pale green that filled the gutters and lined the streets. But for the first time in her life, by the time the trees hung empty, she would be living somewhere else. The Sunday before she left for Michigan, Upper Room took up a love offering to send her on her way. She was the first one in the congregation to earn an academic scholarship to a big university, but it didn't cover everything. She would need little things, like a real winter coat. So the pastor asked Nadia and her father to stand at the altar with an empty paint bucket by their feet. Second John tossed in his cigarette money. He'd promised his wife he'd cut back anyway. Sister Willis gave the cash she'd set aside for her Powerball ticket and whispered to Magdalena Price that her numbers better not win that week. Even the mothers tossed in a few dollars, long used to stretching Social Security checks like watered-down dish soap. Nadia had been so distracted by member after member who rose to give that she almost didn't notice Luke at first sitting in the back pew. He wore a gray suit that dug into his shoulders, and when her eyes flicked to his, her father's arm around her shoulders felt tighter. After service, while her father stood in the receiving line to thank the pastor, she felt Luke sidle up behind her in the lobby.
"Can we talk?" Luke asked.
She nodded, following him past the congregation gathering in the lobby, out the front door, and around the church to the garden in the back. Violet African daisies bunched around the fountain, and a bitter-leafed acacia spread over the stone bench where Luke sat, stretching out his bad leg. She lowered herself beside him.
"Heard you got in a wreck," he said.
"Months ago," she said.
"You okay?"
She hated his fake concern. She pushed herself to her feet.
"I don't have the money," she said.
"What?"
"The offering. My dad has it, but I'll pay you back."
"Nadia."
"600, right? I'd hate for you to feel like you ever did me any favors."
"I'm sorry."
Luke glanced over his shoulder, then leaned toward her, lowering his voice.
"I couldn't go to that clinic if someone had seen me. So you didn't give a shit if someone saw me? It's different. You're not the pastor's kid."
"I needed you," she said, "and you left me."
"I'm sorry," he said softer.
"I didn't want to."
"Well, you did."
"No,"
he said.
"I didn't want to kill our baby."
She would later imagine their baby growing up. Baby takes his first steps. Baby throws his bottle across the room. Baby learns to jump. Always baby, although sometimes she wondered what she would have named him. Luke after his father, or Robert after her own. She even thought of more distant family names, like her mother's father, Israel. But she couldn't imagine a baby bearing the heaviness of that name, its biblical sternness. So baby he remained, even though in her mind he grew into a boy, a teenager, a man. After Luke had said for the first time, "our baby," not the baby, not it, she couldn't help wondering who baby would have become. That night, the flying bridge was mostly empty, except for fishermen sharing around at the bar, their thick backs hunched in flannel. She pushed through the front door toward the booth in the back where Aubrey was waiting. Sometimes she thought about telling Aubrey everything, about Luke, about the abortion. She imagined the two of them in a dark room, how she would take a shaky breath and confess, how Aubrey would tell her that she had been forgiven. Sometimes she wondered if this was what had drawn her to Aubrey, if some small part of her thought that by gathering near to Aubrey, with her purity ring and her good heart, she would somehow be absolved. She would close her eyes and feel Aubrey's hand on her forehead, all of her sins lifting out of her body.
"What's wrong?"
Aubrey said, as soon as Nadia sat. Maybe Nadia could tell her how she hadn't been ready to be a mother, to forfeit her future, how she couldn't imagine how she could live any longer trapped in a house that only reminded her of her mother, how she'd thought she and Luke had both agreed it would be for the best, but how she hadn't really cared because she was granted the right to be selfish this one time, wasn't she? She would be the one sharing her body with a whole new person, so she should get to decide, right? But then Luke's face today, when he'd told her that he'd wanted the baby, not the baby, our baby, which had gutted her since she'd never imagined that he might. What young man did? He was supposed to be relieved that he'd been freed of his responsibilities, that she had handled the difficult part and resolved their problem. But maybe Luke was horrified by what she'd done. Maybe he'd left her at the clinic because he couldn't even stand to look at her after. She could tell Aubrey all of this, and Aubrey would understand. Or she wouldn't. Her face would fall the way Luke's had, in horror and disgust, and she would back away from the booth, unable to conceive of how anyone could kill a poor, defenseless baby. Or she would say she understood, but her smiles would tighten, never quite reaching her eyes, and she would call less and less until they stopped talking altogether. She would disappear, like everyone eventually did. Nadia pushed away from the booth, suddenly feeling trapped. She wandered to the pool table, tracing her hand along the green felt. Her father had taught her how to shoot pool when she was young. He'd brought her to his commanding officer's house for a Christmas party. And while his friends drank spiked eggnog, he'd spent the evening in the back with her, teaching her how to shoot pool. After, they'd driven home slowly, circling through neighborhoods to look at the Christmas lights. Despite her pleading, her father never bothered to put up Christmas lights at their house, but he still drove her around to show her the beautiful designs other people had created. "Do you play?" Aubrey asked. When Nadia shook her head, she said, "Wanna learn? You play pool?" "Casey taught me." She grabbed a cue stick, handing Nadia the other one. "Don't worry, I'll show you." She patiently guided her through the basics, then stood behind her to correct her stance. Aubrey's hair tickled the back of her neck as she guided her hand back for her first stroke. Nadia wanted to feel the soft, constant pressure of another person's touch. She wanted Aubrey to hold her, even if it was a fake embrace. "Can you show me again?" she said. Chapter 6.
We left the world, each in her own time and way. Betty left when her husband died. On a business trip, he fell asleep one night and never woke up. Didn't seem right to her for anyone to die in a Motel 6, alone until a maid pushed in carts of clean towels. She thought of that moment often, how the maid must have shrieked, backing into the metal cart until it tipped, laundry flapping into the air. Betty imagined herself wrapping her husband in one of those fluffy white towels and holding him in her lap. But he had already left the world, so she left with him. Flora left the world when her children fought over who would care for her. She had wet herself again and listened to them argue while she sat in her own mess. Agnes left the world long ago, when she'd gone to the store with her children and the white man behind the counter said, "Let's see how much money you got there, gal." He made her empty her pocketbook on the counter, a few coins spiraling out, while he laughed and her children watched. "Child," she says, "this world ain't got nothing good for me. Nothing that I want, that's for sure." We tried to love the world. We cleaned after this world, scrubbed its hospital floors and ironed its shirts, sweated in its kitchens and spooned school lunches, cared for its sick and nursed its babies. But the world didn't want us, so we left and gave our love to Upper Room. Now we're afraid of this world. A boy snatched Hattie's purse one night, and now none of us go out after dark. We hardly go anywhere at all besides Upper Room.
We've seen what this world has to offer. We're scared of what it wants.
In Michigan, Nadia Turner learned how to be cold, to wear gloves even though she couldn't text with them on, to never text and walk because you might slip on a patch of ice. She learned to wear a scarf, to always wear a scarf. They weren't just decorative like the ones she wore in California with her tank tops. To always get her free flu shot at the student health clinic. She started taking cod liver oil pills that her boyfriend Shadi swore by, or at least his Sudanese mother did, sending them to him by the boxful. He'd grown up in Minneapolis, so he knew how to be cold. He told her about stuffing heat-warming packs in her pockets, how it was better to melt ice with sand instead of salt, how she should start taking a vitamin D supplement because she was black.
"You think I'm joking," he said, "but it's unnatural being colored in all this cold. We need more sunlight than these white people."
She looked it up on her phone. He was right. People with darker skin did need more vitamin D. But he was also right about feeling unnatural in Ann Arbor. She had never lived in a place so white. She had been the only black girl before, in restaurants, in advanced placement classes. But even then, she was surrounded by Filipinos and Samoans and Mexicans. Now she looked out into lecture halls filled with white kids from rural Michigan towns. In discussion sections, she listened to white classmates champion the diversity of their school, how progressive and accepting it was. And maybe if you had come from some farm town, it seemed that way. She felt the sly type of racism here, longer waits for tables, white girls who expected her to walk on the slushy part of the sidewalk, a drunk boy outside a salsa club yelling that she was pretty for a black girl. In a way, subtle racism was worse because it made you feel crazy. You were always left wondering, was that actually racist? Had you just imagined it? She'd met Shadi at a black student union meeting her friend Ekua dragged her to in the fall of her freshman year. Barack Obama had just been elected president, and the BSU and Gay Straight Alliance were co-hosting a forum to discuss whether high black voter turnout also caused the gay marriage ban to pass in California. By then, Nadia had already grown tired of town hall meetings, but she'd gone because she was homesick. She stood in the back, piling her plate with free Boston Market, when she noticed Shadi on the panel. He had deep brown skin and a smile that broke his face in half, turning his already slanted eyes into crescents. He was nerdy in black horn-rimmed glasses, but his body seemed lean and athletic, even under his sweater. He had boxed growing up, she would later learn, which seemed so unlike him, so needlessly dangerous for a man who still swallowed cod liver oil pills because his mother told him to. He was nothing like the boys she usually liked, brash and showy boys who didn't even carry book bags to school, only tucking the thinnest binder under an arm as if to advertise how little they cared. Shadi was, she could already tell, about something. He out-debated everyone on the panel. Even though he raced through so many different points, she often couldn't tell which side he was on. He challenged the idea of there even being sides.
"What's with this black versus gay bullshit?" he asked at one point, leaning into the table. "There are black gay people, you know."
For a second, her heart sank. Was he talking about himself? But after the meeting ended, he wandered over to the back and asked what she thought. He stuck his hands in his pockets, head bowed as she spoke, and she realized that he had noticed her in the back the whole evening, that he had been showing off for her. Maybe he was like the boys she normally liked, at least a little. Shadi was passionate about human rights. In their sophomore year, he started a campus newspaper dedicated to reporting news about political movements in Palestine and Sudan and North Korea. She found herself reading about places that had always seemed vague and distant to her. When she told him she'd received an email about studying abroad, he urged her to apply. In the winter of their sophomore year, he went to Beijing and she went to Oxford.
"Is it safe?"
her father said when she'd called to tell him she'd been accepted. "It's England, not Afghanistan."
"How much does it cost?"
"My scholarship covers it," she said, not mentioning that she'd picked up a job at Noodles & Company in addition to her work study to pay for it.
"And you have all your documents," he said, "your passport and stuff."
Shadi had driven her to the passport office to get her picture taken. He already had stamps in his from visits to France, South Africa, and Kenya, and she realized, waiting in the tiny office, that her mother had never even left the country. This would be her life, accomplishing the things her mother had never done. She never celebrated this, unlike her friends who were proud to be the first in their family to go to college, or the first to earn a prestigious internship. How could she be proud of lapping her mother when she had been the one to slow her down in the first place? Winter in England was gray and dreary, but it was better than a Michigan winter. Anything was better than a Michigan winter. She felt like every winter would kill her, and when she reached the skyless Februaries and bleak Marches, she promised herself she would book the soonest flight back to California. Then spring broke, always unexpectedly, and Ann Arbor slipped into its quiet, humid summers, and she felt normal again, sunning her legs at restaurant patios, lounging on rooftops, and willing the sun to hang above her longer. This had surprised her most about Ann Arbor. She could feel normal here. In Ann Arbor, she was not the girl whose mother had shot herself in the head. She was just a girl from California, a girlfriend to an ambitious boy, a student who loved to party but somehow always made it to class. At home, loss was everywhere. She could barely see past it, like trying to look out a window pane covered in fingerprints. She would always feel trapped behind that window, between her and the rest of the world. But at least in Ann Arbor, the glass was clearer. Whenever they Skyped or texted or talked on the phone, Aubrey asked when she would come home. "Soon," Nadia always said, although she found countless reasons not to return. Summer internships in Wisconsin and Minnesota, service learning trips in Detroit for Thanksgiving, Christmas at Shadi's, where there was no baby Jesus or manger, but his mother set up a tree and sled in reindeer. Their whole house as American and wintry as a Coca-Cola commercial. Nadia wondered if it was only for her benefit, if they thought this would make her feel comfortable, like if she had canceled last minute, they would have just rolled away all the decorations like a playset and ordered Chinese food. She tried not to think about her father, alone on another holiday, and she turned in Shadi's bed toward the window and the houses blanketed in snow. 2 years after Nadia Turner vanished, Luke Shepherd began walking to Martin Luther King Jr. Park to watch the Cobras. He'd never even known the semi-professional football team existed until he'd gotten hurt. Then he'd started looking for football everywhere, downloading NFL podcasts, watching Pop Warner games out of the window of his truck, listening to the cheerful bleat of the whistle as little boys, tottering under pads and helmets, knocked into each other. Parents in lawn chairs cheered when the boys tackled, when they fell, when the ball squirted out of their arms, when they did anything at all. Luke had stumbled upon the Cobras that winter, a month after he moved into his apartment. He'd gone to MLK Park to do pull-ups because he couldn't afford rent and a gym membership, and halfway through his workout, a bus pulled up, black and copper with a snake flicking its tongue, coiled on the side. He pretended to do push-ups while the team climbed out and split into their practice formations. The receivers, lanky, lean, and cocky, he could always spot them, bunched up before practicing their routes. He eased close to the ground, then away. The grass rose and fell, and he felt his hamstrings tighten, his fingertips missing the stubbly firmness of a football. That was 3 months ago. Now he searched online for any mention of the team. He'd learned the names of the starting offensive players, their day jobs, and their nicknames, and when he saw them around town, waiting for an oil change or pushing a cart through Walmart, he mumbled them to himself. Right tackle Jim Finson, plumber, fender bender. He went to the park early on Saturday mornings to watch the team practice. He missed falling into those neat lines. He wanted to get back into football shape, stop eating fried food between shifts, stop drinking beer and smoking weed, and start treating his body like a machine again, an unfeeling, unwanting thing. He'd lowered to the ground for another push-up when he noticed the coach heading toward him.
"Thought you looked familiar," Coach Wagner said.
He grinned, sticking out his hand.
"I remember you. San Diego State. Speedy wideout. But that leg."
"It's better now," Luke said.
"Yeah?"
He ran a hitch route. His right leg felt gummy from the lack of exercise, his left burning as soon as he cut inside. When he trotted back over, Coach Wagner was frowning.
"Getting there," he said. "Look, call me when it's healed up all the way. We could use you."
The Cobras did not pay their players. Any money the team made went toward equipment and transportation, but Luke didn't care. He slid the business card into his pocket. Beside the coach's phone number, there was a glossy emblem of a snake, and he ran his thumb across it his whole walk home.
"Don't you think you should focus on your career?"
his mother asked the next night. He hunched over the kitchen table, stirring his dirty rice. He hated going to Sunday dinner at his parents' house, but not enough to turn down free food and free laundry. When he walked in, his father cleared his throat and said,
"Didn't see you at church this morning."
And since Luke had stopped coming up with creative excuses, he just shrugged. He daydreamed during his father's endless grace, and while his parents discussed upper room, he ate, imagining how long the leftovers he would take with him might last. He normally survived Sunday dinner without saying much, but he'd brushed the business card in his pocket and felt an unusual excitement. For the first time, he'd felt like he had news worth sharing. But his mother just raised an eyebrow, and his father sighed, slipping his glasses off his face.
"Get a job, Luke," his father said.
"I have one," Luke said. "I mean a real one, not that restaurant crap."
"And what about your leg?" his mother said. "What happens when you get hit again? It don't hurt that bad."
His mother shook her head.
"Listen, I know you love football, but you got to be realistic now."
"When are you going to take some responsibility, Luke?"
his father said. "When?"
Maybe he was being irresponsible, but he didn't care. He just wanted to be good at something again. By June, he was going to the park every day to run drills. CJ couldn't throw a tight spiral, but he learned the routes, the sharp angle of a post, the soft curl of a button hook. He knew where to put the ball, and he joked that if Luke could catch balls thrown by him, he'd be able to grab the ones thrown by a real quarterback. CJ wasn't as bad as he thought, which annoyed Luke. He envied CJ, even with his mediocre talent, because he had a body that worked right, that followed orders without complaint, not one that had splintered apart.
"I'm slow as shit, man," he said, huffing.
"I mean, you fucked up your leg." CJ plopped on the grass in his gray gym shorts from high school, which still had his name written on the thigh in marker.
"It's gonna take some time."
"Ain't got time," Luke said. "Let's go again." After evening workouts, he bought CJ a beer, and they drank outside Hosey's, watching girls in bikinis trail in from the beach, sand clinging to their legs.
"You still talk to your girl?"
CJ asked one night. Luke took a sip of lukewarm beer, always slow, tiny sips, wanting to make it last.
"Who?"
he said.
"That high school chick you was fucking with."
"She's not my girl," Luke said.
"I heard she's living in, like, Russia right now."
"Russia?
Or some shit like that. She's living in Russia and fucking with some African nigga."
Luke sipped his beer again, swishing it around his mouth. When she'd first left, he used to obsess over the college boys Nadia was touching. He imagined them, never athletic boys like him, but preppy boys in Michigan sweaters who scurried around campus, stacks of books clutched against their chests. Now he had a name. Shadi Walid, some Arab-sounding motherfucker. At Fat Charlie's, he searched him on the computer in the staff room and found pages of articles Shadi had written for some newspaper called The Blue Review. A blog post, of course he blogged, about, Luke was surprised to discover, football. Football as in soccer, but he was shocked that Shadi was interested in regular things like sports. Although the blog post was about how France's World Cup hopes rested on their Muslim forward, and wasn't that ironic. Luke didn't understand what was so ironic, but it must have been another thing that Shadi Walid knew that he didn't. He finally landed on Shadi's Facebook. His breath caught when he saw the profile picture. Shadi lounging on a black chair outside a restaurant, Nadia Turner on his lap in a long floral sundress, smiling behind sunglasses, her hand gently draped across Shadi's shoulder. She looked older now, her face more angular, her cheekbones sharpened. She looked happy. Luke flipped through the other photos, mostly posters for campus events, a few of Shadi hunching over a woman in a headscarf who must have been his mother, but he always returned to the one of Nadia in Shadi's lap. Her life had gone on like nothing had happened, but Luke was stuck, wedged in the past, always wondering what would have happened if they'd kept the baby. Their baby.
"Who the fuck is that?"
a busboy asked Luke, pointing at Shadi's smiling face.
"Your boyfriend?"
He cackled, but Luke shoved away from the computer so hard, the desk shook. When he joined the Cobras, Luke thought his anger might finally subside, but instead, he felt it growing. Football was a safe place to be angry. Every time he laced up, he cupped his anger, keeping it safe. The first time he got hit in practice, he saw a white flash, his mind washed over with pain. Then he pushed himself off the ground and hobbled back to the huddle. That hit made him feel like himself again. He started shit-talking, taunting men double his size who could cripple him with another blow.
That's all you got, bitch? Come on, motherfucker, try me again.
The next play, the same linebacker came loping toward him, and Luke cut inside, breezing past him as the ball smacked into his hands and he sprinted into the end zone. He felt almost disappointed he hadn't been hit again. His anger belonged here. Hell, all of the Cobras were angry. Every one had a story of near fame and missed chances. The coach who'd fucked them over. The family debt that forced them to drop out and get a job. The recruiter who never saw their full potential. No one's anger was more welcomed than his, because the team pitied him the most. He was the youngest, the one most robbed of his future, so the other players were kind to him. Roy Tabbitt invited him on fishing trips. Edgar Harris changed his oil for free. Jeremy Fincher loaned him a tux so he didn't have to rent one for a friend's wedding.
"Don't fuck it up either, dick breath," Finch said, handing over the garment bag.
It was the nicest thing anyone had done for Luke in months.